Hello, and welcome to Xena Podcast. I'm Jackson Grubb, the host. I'm here with Shane Munton, our guest host, because Carly is out of town.
Yep.
I was out of town last week. I was in D.C., and now she's out of town, and I'm not really sure where she is, but we're happy to have Shane with us.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm excited to be here. We're here with Jennifer Kajiyama. She's a professor over legal studies. She's been teaching at BYU Hawaii for 10 years, and before that, she practiced family law in Utah for about the same amount of time, right? 10 to 11, right after you graduated.
How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me on your podcast. I'm excited to be here. I'm also a little nervous.
It's okay. No pressure. There's no stakes. There's no winners and losers in this. But you were in a pretty adversarial profession yourself. You worked in family law, and we just kind of wanted to talk about that. But first, if you didn't have to sleep, what would you do with the extra time?
I would eat.
Just 8 hours?
But I want to. Well, I would want to go and try all these famous eating places, and then I probably should learn how to cook them. So yeah. Eat, taste, and find what I like, and then try to recreate it.
Yeah, reverse engineer kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. What's your favorite place to eat on the island?
I really like ramen, so Japanese noodles, and we go to a place called Gomate with my family, and it's authentic pork roasted broth and yummy noodles. And
is that in town?
That's in town, uh-huh.
We'll have to try that.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, could you tell us a little bit about how you got involved in family law?
Sure. It just sort of happened by default. I was looking for work after my second year of law school, and there were some jobs that were posted at our law school, and I needed something that was a little bit more flexible because I was working at the law school as a research assistant and a teaching assistant, and so this would be my third job, but then this job opened up at a family law firm in Provo.
Did that interest in family law, did that start while you were in law school before, or was it just because there was a job opening?
It really was because there was this job opening.
Really?
I wanted something that would be really practical, that I knew I could use when I would graduate. But I, going to law school, I didn't really know any attorneys, and no one in my family comes from a law background, and so, I had really no major experiences until I came to law school, and I didn't even anticipate that family law would be what I do now.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's a very fulfilling job, and when I first thought about it, before I went to law school, I was like, that's crazy. I don't think I could do it. It's so emotionally draining, and you hear a lot of really sad circumstances. And anyway, but I find it now, especially because of my own experiences, that I greatly enjoy doing family law, and I feel like it's a very healing profession, and I can be a really important tool to help parties heal.
So what did you think you were going to do when you started law school? What body of law were you interested in?
I was interested in doing constitutional law or civil rights litigation. I thought I was going to help defend the minority groups or people who've traditionally been voiceless. And I enjoyed studying those things in law school, but the experiences I had in law school sort of, I was talking about working for this family law firm, it sort of kind of put me down a trajectory of what I'm practicing now, which is primarily family law.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned that you were the first lawyer in your family, first person to go to law school. I imagine it had something to do with your wanting to go into constitutional law and just kind of help the little guy, right? So what experience, if any, kind of pushed you towards going to law school?
I think that's a really valid question. But learning more about, my own family situation and the history that they've experienced, and me not knowing their stories, and when I found out about it, it really made me feel like I needed to have a voice, and I felt like the law was a really good avenue for that. So when I was growing up, I just thought I had just a traditional family that everyone has, and my parents, I didn't really know that my parents, or my dad specifically, and his upbringing was any different than my friends. But I found out when I was in eighth grade, and I read the book Hiroshima that my father, and I was just casually talking to him about this book I was reading about a place that I knew he was from, that I found out for the first time that he was a survivor of the bombing of Hiroshima. Wow. And I remember years later, we went to Hiroshima Peace Memorial Park and seeing really for the first time my very stoic, very, you know, kind father breaking down in tears and understanding, I guess, really the impact that laws can have and that policy and words can have in shaping someone's life very personally. And I saw that also. So my dad's from Japan, obviously, but my mom's side, they're from America. And my dad actually has relatives that grew up in the United States as well. And on the opposite end, during World War II, there were members of these families that were interned in camps, losing businesses and homes. And again, through the use of like rhetoric and policy, my family life was really affected. And so I guess I was, after those experiences and learning about my own past, it really made me aware that there are, for big chunks of time or periods of time, there have been groups of people who've been voiceless, either because they couldn't speak the language, or maybe culturally they're not one to question authority, that type of thing. And so I knew growing up, when I was very young, my grandma always told me, my mom's mom, that if I ever wanted to have a voice or make a difference in society, I had to be educated. Mm-hmm. And I needed to be educated specifically in, I guess, in the workings of government and law. And so when I went to law school, that's what I envisioned, that I would help to be a voice for others who did not traditionally have a voice for themselves.
Well, I mean, you still represent clients. Could you talk a little bit about how that experience, or how those motives still play out in family law? I mean, like, what does a family lawyer do, I guess, to give some background?
Family law does allow me to be a voice, and I really appreciate that. Now that I practice family law, I can really see how important it is that the clients that I represent, that they know the process and they know the types of stories that they need to tell in order to, I guess, help the judge or even the other attorney or the guardian ad litem, whoever's appointed to the case, to understand their perspective. And so a family law attorney can do a myriad of things. I primarily deal with custody and child support kinds of issues, parent time, visitation, trying to change up a previously agreed upon divorce decree, like modifying that. But I think that my job is primarily to, I guess, stand up for the children or protect the children. My clients, of course, are the people who I'm employed by, but I always want to, with whatever decision we make, going forward in the litigation process or modification process, that the interests of the children or the child is at the center of the decision-making process.
Absolutely. You have a daughter yourself, right?
I do. I have a 9-year-old who will be turning 10 in like a week and a half.
Oh, wow. So exciting.
So, and my own personal experiences have, having gone through a pretty difficult divorce and then subsequent court proceedings that I've gone through myself dealing with divorce, has really helped me, I guess, have empathy and understanding for both sides, I guess, both parties involved in the litigation process. And like, especially seeing the effect. My daughter was quite young when we got divorced, but seeing how it affects her in terms of like the visitation schedule, not really, again, this idea of not having a voice, like she's at kind of the mercy of the attorneys and then the judge or whoever's appointed to the case to decide her fate, I guess. Yeah. And mm-hmm. So I'm really mindful of that when I try to counsel my clients. And I always tell them to keep that in mind, and also to consider any choice that they make in their interactions with the other spouse, to consider, I guess, the ramifications on the children, but also if they were to go to a court, how would a judge look at their reaction or what they've done, if it's reasonable in their eyes? And if it's not, then not to take that course.
You know, it's not too often that attorneys get to have a look at both sides of the argument. So I imagine that makes you a lot more effective as an attorney. So living in Hawaii and practicing in Utah, how do you make that work, I guess, just with the distance?
Right. I don't handle a ton of cases, but the cases I deal with usually are pretty straightforward, I guess. Mm-hmm. They are things like an uncontested divorce. So both parties have agreed that they want to be separated. Uncontested means that they agree to all of the terms. So it's pretty standard, just the filing of it. And we file all of our documents online in Utah. I also just review documents from other attorneys, or I'll draft things, and then another attorney will sign off on them.
How does it work when one party wants a divorce and the other one does not?
And then that's a contested divorce. And so I always tell clients, if that's the case and they want to get divorced but the other party doesn't, that you will eventually be divorced. It's just a matter of time to kind of reconcile the differences and the amount of money that you want to put into it, yeah. I guess. But Utah is, is a no-fault divorce state. So as long as there's a party who's unhappy and would like to see them divorced, then... yeah, it's definitely going to happen.
Okay. This is a question that actually we had. Are there any strange, like, cultural or legal anomalies to Utah that kind of make it a unique place to practice law?
I don't really know, I guess, because I don't practice in other states. But I do know that what's required by law in Utah is there's a big push for mediation. And so if there's any parties who have any part of their divorce proceeding that they can't agree on, whether it's who gets the grandfather clock or who's going to take on the debt from school. If there's just some little portion big portion that they don't agree upon, they have to go through mediation. So that's something that I also did while I was in law school, was I became a certified court mediator. So we'd go to the small claims court primarily, and then we'd work with parties to help them kind of come to an agreement without having it go before a judge and have the judge make the final decision.
How do you, this is kind of a big question, but how do you get people to play nice?
Well, when we're talking about divorce, I did small claims court mediation, but I'm also a certified divorce mediator. And when parties are divorcing, it's usually because they cannot get along. And there's probably, in most cases, at the heart of it, there's some very emotionally, they have strong emotional ties to what's going on, and so it's not easy. But one job, what your job is supposed to be as a mediator, is you're supposed to help the parties kind of focus on their mutual, I guess, the things that they will be mutually beneficial to them. And when it's divorce and there's children involved, that's usually what's best for the children. And my role is just to help guide them through the process. Now, the laws in Utah say that for mediation, parties have to exert good faith effort in the mediation process, which doesn't necessarily mean too much. They have to show up, and then they have to try. And if they can't come to an agreement, then it'll proceed through the court. So. Yeah. But one thing that's helpful as a divorce mediator that's also an attorney is that I can kind of point to what the law traditionally, the standard provisions in the law, and kind of indicate from my own experiences what I would think a judge would do in a circumstance, and remind them that, you know, somewhere around that ballpark is probably reasonable in terms of agreeing to something, so that... I think parties oftentimes in mediation, they worry that they're either giving in too easily, or that they could have maybe, they should have asked for something more. And so they're never really sure, like, what their safe, I guess, bottom line should be. Mm-hmm. So a good mediator can help bring the parties together by focusing them on, I guess, the boundaries in which they're playing, the rules of the game.
Yeah. So as someone who's just constantly surrounded by all this chaos and turmoil of just families kind of falling apart and having to witness that, how are you able to personally keep an optimistic view on family and I guess just marriage in general?
It might just be my nature. I think I am a natural optimist. But I have seen how the law can be a source of healing. And I tell my students all the time, but one of my favorite talks comes from President James E. Faust, where he talks about how lawyers are healers and counselors at law. And if an attorney, they don't have to be a member of the church, but an attorney has the Holy Ghost with them when they're talking with their clients. Again, I'm not suggesting that in order to have the Holy Ghost, you have to kowtow to what the other party is requesting. Mm-hmm. But if you truly, as an attorney, if you're motivated by the good intention, or on focusing on what's best for your clients as well as for their children, I think it can be a source of great comfort, and it can end the conflict from continuing. So attorneys, traditionally, I mean, we make our money by conflict, especially in family law, yeah. Right? The more conflict, then the more cases we get, and we can bill for those mm-hmm. things. And it seems counterintuitive that a good attorney is going to help someone heal so that they won't have these circumstances. But if you can focus the parties again on their children, or on, you know, that you want both of them to leave better and to move on with their lives, you can do that with the law. And we can come up with a good agreement that both parties feel that they can comply with, they feel happy about.
That's great.
You can move forward.
Yeah, I mean, that conflict is always going to be there, so why not just make the most of it mm-hmm. and do what you can to heal? I think that's great.
Yeah. It's just an interesting talk, because I've got interested in family law and just law in general, and my parents are divorced, so I asked both of them separately, obviously, how was the court proceedings? How was the divorce? But I was trying to ask them, like, minus all the emotional stuff, mm-hmm. but both of them said the exact same thing. They said, you can't take that out of it. Like, for them, it's like, it's always going to be emotional. And I was like, but I'm just trying to learn about the law. And they're just like, well, it was just a very emotional time. So I guess, kind of going back to that, like, how do you separate yourself from, so like, I guess you talked already about how you're able to separate them from, or trying to get them focused on mutual benefit, but how do you not take the drama home with you?
That's a good question too. I may not be the best at answering this, but I think it's because I've gone through the experience. just the stress of being involved in a family law dispute. That I really, when I have the clients with me at that moment, I want to make sure that. Try to address as many concerns as I can for them, so that when they leave, they're not just like constantly thinking about it and then, you know, maybe emailing me questions. I mean, they surely can do that, but I try to let them know that, like, when we're together, and again, I'm billing it for these hours that are this time we're meeting, that this is the time to ask those questions and try to resolve it. And so then I try, when I go home, to just sort of turn off from that and just focus on my daughter. But the hardest part, I think, about family law is that it's not like a 8-to-5 job. And a lot of the disputes that take place surround visitation. And so children going back and forth between parents on holidays, on the weekends. Maybe there's a dispute about, I don't know, something that takes place like at midnight or 1 or 2 in the morning. And so it's like, it's not a standard like schedule that you're responding to things. So I think a big frustration for a lot of like clients they have with family law attorneys is that like they don't respond fast enough because they need an answer, or they need the attorney there during some, like, you know, during Christmas vacation, and maybe they're not available at that time. But I try to remember that, because I know what it's like to have your child have to go. And anyway, to having the support of your attorney there is really important. And I've had good attorneys who've been there for me as well. So
you didn't represent yourself? Or is that...
No, I didn't represent myself. You could. And if you're not an attorney, you'd be the pro se litigant representing yourself. But I couldn't do it. It's really emotionally difficult, and just like you're saying, Jackson, it's very hard to separate your emotion from the process. Yeah. And I am an attorney, and I reverence the law, and I am grateful for the court system. But the court system, I feel like one of the big drawbacks of it is that it sets people up for contention and conflict. I mean, there's going to be somebody who's filing a charge against you, and so automatically the other party has to fight back. Like, they have to defend themselves. And so when you're in a defense mode or an offensive mode, you're not in the mindset to like, oh, well, how do we get along so that we can come to an agreement, right? And you're already like defending and standing your ground. So anyway, if we can help the parties. Like, that's why I think mediation, divorce mediation is a requirement in Utah is a really positive thing, because parties are starting the process with, let's see what we can do to agree. Yeah. And maybe the areas we can't agree on, we can go to court. But let's start with the mindset first of, like, what's best for our children or our future.
That's great. Yeah. I think it's best to have that mindset early on. Do you have any clients that you keep in contact with still?
Yes. No, I do. I guess one of the blessings of being an attorney is the ability that I have, like, I have a specialized, I guess, skill set mm-hmm. that not everybody has, of course, but that allows me to step in and help people who can't help themselves. And so I can do a lot of pro bono work, so I can just volunteer and help people going through similar circumstances, which is, that has been really rewarding for me. In my own personal experience as well, I had some very kind, good people mm-hmm. who did that for me. And when you're going through, like, litigation and you're hearing about everything that's involved and all the court fees and all the attorney's fees and mm-hmm. all the specialists and experts that you're going to need on your side, it's so expensive and it can be really overwhelming. And so when I was able to help a few people that way, it just made me so grateful for the education that I received. And I don't know if anybody's listening to this that's a student or female, but I want you to know that like, your education, not only will it benefit you, but it can be a great source of, like, strength and healing for so many people. And it's a tool that Heavenly Father has given to you to serve in a way that, especially with the law, your education can be a vehicle to help somebody who is unable to help themselves. And the Lord will give you key experiences and the education you need to do that. But it's really important to look back and to use those skills to give back. And it's so rewarding to be able to do that.
So you talk about the importance of education. And I know that you did some research about learning a little bit about your own history and about, personal history. So what is that about?
That's a great question. I remember when I was an undergrad and I read a book, Things Fall Apart by Chinua Achebe. And he's a novelist, historian, and he talked about the importance of a storyteller and how it's one of the most important roles in society is to have the ability to create the memories and to shape your telling of the past so that your descendants or those who survive that experience, that they understand, like, your perspective, and that the people who create the stories, that they're the ones who are in positions of power. And so for groups that typically have not had the storytelling power, and something that, of course, that was of interest to me was, as an Asian American, was learning about the discriminatory laws that really affected specifically, like, me as a Japanese American. I wanted to be a storyteller for those types of groups.
Could you give some background about the history of the discriminatory laws, just to give context?
This isn't necessarily, like, legally, like, legal cases, but I know one thing I studied in my undergrad that we presented at a conference, a national conference, was about how Asian Americans, the misperception of them and the misrepresentation of them in media, and how there's a need to have better, to have films that more accurately depict, like, these groups and the telling of these groups. And I remember one of the books we covered was it was a Japanese American story, and the main character that was cast was a native Chinese speaker and actress who played the part of the Japanese American woman. And at least it was an Asian that was being represented, but it's been from black and white films to color films, like even having non-Asian, Caucasian Mickey Rooney playing the Japanese individual. I mean, not an accurate telling. And so when I was in law school, I began to learn more about, like, national origin discrimination when people are coming, like, in terms of immigration law, how many, like, Chinese could come in. And they had, you know, the exclusionary acts preventing Chinese from coming to America. And then later on, because there were already segments, big segments of like Asians in the country already, like Japanese Americans. An example is like in Seattle, local laws or ordinances were passed that prevented a non-citizen from getting a business license, which basically at that time in Seattle, a lot of the pawnbrokers were Asians and specific Japanese Americans. And so the law might seem to be very neutral on its face, but it was a pretext to hide the fact that they were targeting a specific race from being able to have a business. And if you don't have a business, you don't have livelihood, then you can't survive. And so it was trying to force these groups out of the country. And there are many instances of that. And from the Korematsu case that went to the Supreme Court, and others that there was a Harvard Law School dean, Harold Hongju Ko, and he said, if we study the Supreme Court and specifically looking at it through the lens of Asian Americans, we can see that it is a tale of great sadness because for many of them, when the laws were passed, they didn't necessarily understand the legal process. There were not attorneys that were there to represent their interests or who could understand culturally, their experiences and try to defend them, accurately in court. And so language has been a way to discriminate against these types of groups. And so one thing that I really hoped to do when I was in law school was that I could, give a voice to these people and help bring understanding. And we can see it even today in terms of criminal law and the defense that's given to individuals who have a state appointed attorney. And those who have income or who have the ability to get an attorney who, is very good at telling their story or who has prominence in the legal community, It's sad, but it's true that it's hard to compete against that, especially when you're trying to make an impression on a jury, specifically juries. So I think the legal system continues in some forms to perpetuate these types of injustice. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important that there's groups now that can recognize this. They try to bring to light through the media what's going on and encouraging people to stand up and speak up.
So you started off wanting to go to law school to give a voice to these people. Your career has obviously shifted a little bit more towards giving a voice to children, more people who have been put at odds with their family. Do you feel like the future maybe might hold something more for going back to what you originally went to law school for, giving a voice to your people and your history?
I definitely think that there needs to be good family law attorneys. And if that's one thing that I can teach my students is that in whatever field, if they're going to law school and they're going to be an attorney, whatever field that they participate in, there's a need for them, and they are going to be the voice for their client. In whatever you're doing, there still has to be a telling of the facts and an explanation of your circumstance and then applying the laws to your facts to make a case, to analyze it, and to persuade a judge or jury. So, we need inspired and honest and compassionate as well as persuasive storytellers.
Absolutely.
And I don't want storytelling to seem like we're fancifully creating our own version of the truth.
Yeah.
Like we are telling the truth, but both sides in the law, in an American common law legal system, adversarial system, both sides, what's great is they have the opportunity to tell their story and they have the opportunity to shape what they believe is their telling of the facts. And so to be a really effective advocate, I believe, is being able to master the art of being able to have enough facts that just speak plainly to what happened, but a little bit of the pathos, the emotional connections that the audience, whoever it is, can understand, the importance of why of the position you're arguing for.
What's an example of a fact that is not necessarily legally significant, but that you would share to try to increase the pathos, that emotional draw?
I can only speak from my family law perspective. I would say, and I want to speak from an example of how a fact could be persuasive I mean, important in the telling. So if it's about the children, the legal standard is the best interest of the child. And so when you share facts about you, if you're trying to say that the child should reside with, like if I'm trying to say this child should reside with this client, then any fact I share, I need to share the most important facts that indicate that.
Okay.
So I can't think of it the opposite way.
Yeah, well, it still makes sense. I guess mine is kind of a loaded question. So that kind of assumes, I assumed that you would share things that weren't necessarily legally significant, but what you're saying is that everything always is focusing towards...
Yeah, everything you share should be legally significant.
Now, I don't know how much you would like to get into this, but what does the future hold for you career-wise? I mean, you started off your practice with family law and you're teaching now. Do you feel like you might get into helping and being a voice for Asian Americans?
I really enjoy what I do right now with teaching, and I'd like to pursue a PhD, like focusing maybe on these issues of representation and filling the vacuum, I guess, in the law with more maybe of an Asian American perspective and in light of culture and I don't know, their kind of experiences that they haven't really been able to share. But I mean, I don't know if I'll practice law full time here in Hawaii. I have to take the bar.
Yeah.
I have to pass the bar here. But I guess for now, my focus is on developing or helping students who are they feel a draw to maybe serving in the legal profession and just giving them the opportunities and guiding them along through their process.
And also maybe just one big life-changing thing at a time. Sister Kajiyama, or Professor Kajiyama, is getting married in a couple of days. Is that right?
Yes. I am getting married, and I mean, I don't know what you want me to share about that.
It's the happy ending.
It's the happy ending. Oh, okay.
Happily ever after.
Yeah.
And then back to the... Well, do you have anything to recommend or any piece of advice for somebody that's interested in family law, somebody that's looking into that?
Yeah. I think for anybody who's thinking not just family law but law in general, I would encourage them to study it out and go and do an internship, volunteer at a law firm. Try all the different kinds of law that you think you might be interested in, and then find out what's the best fit for you. I didn't think that family law was going to be the best fit for me when I started out, but because of my own life experiences, I find it to be such a empowering and a healing field where I'm doing a lot of good. I would also just encourage students. I remember looking at attorneys and what I would see portrayed in like television shows or movies and thinking like, I can't do that. That's not my personality. And so what I would just say, I mean, for those who are listening to this, I don't know how many of you, anyway, you don't may not know me, but my voice and the way, if you saw me, I'm very tiny.
We'll take a picture after this. You'll be able to see.
I may not look like the traditional attorney and I don't fit that mold. And I've shared this with my students before, but I remember being in law school and a former judge, or I think he was still a judge, who did my criminal trial class, we did an assignment where we had to give an opening statement, and after I worked really hard on it and after I shared it, hearing the judge critique me to say that I would never be a good attorney because my voice was too high and I was already petite to begin with and I smiled too much in my opening statement and that they couldn't take what I was saying very seriously. So that could be very devastating, right?
Yeah.
In law school, that's what you hear.
The professor's just like, you're never going to be a lawyer.
And a judge, you know, I was like, this is the worst news. But I use that as like the fuel and motivation to say, well, can I change my height? No. Can I change the voice, like my voice? I really can't do much about my voice. And I mean, What can I do? So I tried to find ways around that of identifying, I guess, the strength and what maybe would be a perceived weakness. And so I will never be tall. I know that. Even when I wear very tall shoes, I will still be quite small compared to most people. But I also realize that I would never come across as, like, intimidating or or scary or threatening. And so that could be something that would help me be relatable to a jury, and also to maybe be relatable to my client or to other attorneys or to a judge. My voice may be high, but it's going to make me stand out. Yeah. And okay, there's a time and a place to smile. I do recognize that. But my smile can be a way to be inviting and can, in a very dark situation, I know this happens when I meet with my clients, like family law clients. Again, some of these individuals are in like the very worst circumstances. And I remember that feeling. It's a very dark time. But if I can smile and be a source of light and to remind them that even though my circumstance is different, that I'm at a period in my life now where there is peace, that there's no conflict and turmoil, and that's something that they can look forward to, then that's okay, you know? So the things that were very much weaknesses or what I thought were just, oh, I can't do this, I can't be an attorney, you know, they weren't. Those were things that could become assets to me. And so for anybody who's listening and they have a desire to be an attorney, to go to law school, to be a leader in some way, you can all do that. And I know that the Lord gives us key opportunities and experiences. I know that He does. And it will probably come through your darkest trials and the moments that you are completely like, why am I going through this now? Yeah. It doesn't make any sense. But because of my experience of having like gone through a really bad divorce and then going through the legal system afterwards and fighting for my daughter and myself and having to stand up for myself, that's not my nature, but it taught me a lot, and it allows me to relate to my clients and to help them when they're going through their trials and their these very difficult moments. And so just know that I believe and I know that there is a purpose to our life and that God's hand is definitely involved. And when we are able to look past ourselves, then I know it's not easy, even for myself, but when we can do that, there's so many opportunities that God gives us to serve and that gives us perspective on our circumstance. And anyway, we can find joy in that time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. Professor Kajiyama is a great example of a selfless servant who does everything she can to help her clients, and we're grateful for her time coming today. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. This has been the Zeno Podcast. You can follow our Facebook and Instagram at Zeno Podcast. That's XENO Podcast.
This podcast was brought to you by BYU Hawaii's Reading Writing Center.
Thanks for learning by listening.